Hello, and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Welcome back to the AMFT podcast and another installment of our all-star panel series, a celebration of the most influential voices in systemic therapy. These episodes bring together past guests, our favorites, pioneers, and innovators to reflect on the heart of our work, how we as therapists create change, mobilize hope, cultivate feedback, and stay grounded in ourselves. Today's all-star panel features three remarkable voices who have each shaped the theory, practice, and spirit of postmodern therapy. I'm talking about Dr. Diane Gayhart, Dr. Gene Combs, and Jill Friedman. Diane is a former professor at Cal State Northridge. She's a prolific author and written some of the field's most widely used and accessible textbook, including Theory and Treatment Planning and Family Therapy, A Competency-Based Approach, Mindfulness and Acceptance in Couple and Family Therapy, and Mastering Competencies in Family Therapy. Known for her clarity, her compassion, and emphasis on mindfulness and social justice, Diane's work continues to inspire both emerging therapists and seasoned clinicians alike. Gene Combs and Jill Friedman, a husband and wife duo, are internationally known for their pioneering contributions to narrative therapy. They are the co-directors of the Chicago Center for Narrative Therapy. Their collaborations include Narrative Therapy, The Social Construction of Preferred Realities, and Symbol, Story, and Ceremony have influenced generations of systemic thinkers, drawing on the ideas of Michael White and David Epstein. Gene and Jill have expanded narrative practice with so much deep respect and creativity, and an ongoing commitment to honoring clients' stories and identities. Together, they've trained thousands of therapists worldwide and remain treasured voices in the movement toward collaborative, socially just therapy. Today's conversation explores not only these three people's unique theoretical contributions, but also their shared commitment to meaning, context, and the power of dialogue, reminding us that the stories we tell shape the lives we live. Let's dive in. Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast. One of my favorite new additions, the all-star panel, and I have three very popular and often requested guests from early on in our seven-season run. Diane, Jill, and Gene, welcome back. We are going to have a great spirited discussion today, and I can't wait. I want to let you start us off, Gene.
I just, since this is a family therapy thing, and we think about context a lot, I would just want to ask listeners to think about their important relationships. And when we say relationships, we mean relation to everything. To the planet, which it's really important to think about these days, to the other peoples on the planet and our interconnection with those peoples, to our ancestors and to the ancestral guardians of whatever place you're in, and just bring your awareness of what's your accountability to all that web of relationships, and what's the ethical way for all of us to be relating to each other and to every other entity in this thing that's really all one thing. If you take relational thinking as seriously as you can and really think about the whole universe is just one whole universe. And We are in a profession that thinks about relationships rather than individuals. So I'm interested to see what this little connectivity that we're making today will bring forth.
It is a beautiful way to start because I've been asking everyone on these all-star panels, again, very important people, pioneers in the field of systemic therapy. If you were to describe to someone, either a potential client or a potential learner who wants to get into this field, what are the major differences between systemic couple and family therapy and a more linear individual therapy? How would you answer that? Gene's already got us going on that, but how do you describe systemic therapy to somebody that doesn't know anything about it?
We can let Gene continue because that was so beautiful, Gene. I'll let you finish your thought.
I do generalities, and maybe it would be good for either of you to jump in and add some specificity to all that up in the cloud stuff I just did.
Maybe I could say something about how doing work with couples and families influences the way, and I'm sure this is true for all of us, influences individual therapy.
Please.
Because when I started doing individual therapy, it was just all about the person in front of me. But having spent a lot of time working with couples and families, even when I'm working with an individual, I'm so aware of the relational context, the important people in that person's life, the history of where ideas and problems, as well as things that are going to be really helpful, are coming from. So there's never just one person in the room anymore. Back when I was just beginning to study, I remember we had a small group that I was really lucky to be part of where with Chloe Madonis, and Jay Haley said, I'm not a good enough therapist to work with individuals. And at the time, I thought that was very funny. But over time, I've just thought that's very true. We have so much more of what we're working with, working in a systemic way with relationships.
That is so true. And if I can just pick up from there, because when I train folks, oftentimes, if, you know, I'm doing something on systemic or family, I'll have people go, but I only work with individuals. And I'm like, oh my goodness, you need this more than someone who's got a couple or the family in the room, because you've got one person and you've got to figure out what's going on and you've got to ask them to figure out how everyone else in the system is thinking. So you actually need systemic concepts more when you're working with individuals, because they're not in their room to defend themselves or to share their perspectives. And so you've got to do a lot more work to figure out what's happening in your client's context. So I think it's a lot more, I agree with you. And it's wild that Jay Haley said that, because I think the more you do this work, the more that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's a misnomer, even in the name of the profession, marriage and family therapy. Obviously, you can be a systemic therapist, a systemic thinker with just one person in the room. And as Jill was saying, many times that is the context of which MFTs practice. More nationally, MFTs see their caseload of 50% individuals, but they're still thinking systemically, and all the people that are in the indirect system, as we say. So I couldn't agree with you all more. Now, another question that is very broad in general, but very interesting. Everybody has a little different way of answering these series of questions is, how does change happen in systemic therapy, and who is responsible for change?
That's a really hard question.
Oh.
Well, I can answer it, or I'll start us off. How about that? I think, as everyone knows, but I'll just say it out loud. So I did a lot of training with Harlene Anderson and working collaboratively. And so I think that's where a lot of my thinking around changes happen. And so I think everyone on this panel, at least, has a very social constructionist understanding of what change is. And so I think of it as, so change happens in relationship, and I think it happens in dialogue. And I think there is something really transformative and powerful in the types of dialogues. I think the people on this panel specifically have, we spent our lives trying to teach this way of having these conversations. But I think what happens in these conversations is you create this safe context, to use non-jargon words, this safe context, a safe relationship, where there is this back and forth exchange of ideas. And I think in these collaborative dialogues, what's happening is your client is able to share kind of their thinking, and we're trying to just understand what they're saying and understand their experience from their perspective. And I have a very kind of silly metaphor that I use because it seems to work the best in the 21st century. And so I'll go ahead and share it real quickly here. So back in the day, there were Star Trek movies, and there was this room called the holodeck. And this metaphor is helpful in understanding change in therapy. And the holodeck is this room that the user can program, and they create the characters, the logic of the system. It is a totally unique kind of world to the user programs it, where the VR headset, someone else has programmed your app. And I like this because I think what we do to create change is we try to enter someone else's meaning-making system. And we do the very best to step out of our holodeck, our meaning-making system, and into their world. But the truth is we're blindfolded. We can't see this other world that they're in. And we have to hold onto their hand and ask curious questions to understand how things operate in their world. And in their world, lions can be grazers and the gazelles can be apex predators. You just don't know till you ask. And you have to get into this highly curious state of mind. And when that happens, what begins to happen is clients put into words things that they normally don't say out loud. They begin to connect the dots themselves. And so as we, from a very not knowing, curious position, ask how all these meanings came to be, they begin to see their world in a different way. And I have not forced any change. I don't know how they're going to connect the dots. But there's this very organic from within the client shift where they begin to see their world differently. Organically, I have not imposed, you know, my biases or views. And that they begin to see new possibilities. And I don't know, Eli, that's my answer. I don't know how that resonates with you, but that's how I try to explain it these days.
Well, very articulate. Jill and Jean, your thoughts on how change happens and who's responsible for it?
I would want to go back to just what's a very basic but really important point to me, which is that change is always happening. The question is, can we influence people's ability to choose the changes that they prefer? I think one of the differences a little bit between our approach, mine and Jill's narrative therapy approach, and collaborative systems, which share so much in common, is that we think a little bit more about the impossibility of withholding our worldview. That we're going to bring our biases in, whether we want to or not. And it's really important to be aware of, as aware as we can, knowing that's also an impossible task, of the influences and the context and the histories that inform the ways that we see what would be a good choice. And to be monitoring very closely that just because we think it's a good choice, we don't just let the conversation drift in that direction without slowing down and saying, from my side of this conversation, I can see we could go here, or we could go here, or we could go there, or that word you just said, here's the meaning that I'm reading into the word, but I don't know if that's the meaning you're reading into it. So to always want to be moving toward what we think is good, that's one of our contributions to the thing, but to do that in a very collaborative and cautious way, knowing that we're not making change happen, we're influencing the direction of the changes that are always happening.
I'm thinking about somebody from our most recent year-long group has sent an email to everybody in the group saying, what questions do you ask when you've done the first session? And I don't have exact questions by and large, but I often ask people, can you tell me something about yourself that has nothing to do with why you're here? Mm-hmm. And the reason that I ask that question is I think it's really important for both of us to not be fooled by the problem into thinking in a limited way about someone, that there's always more. For me, part of what guides that curiosity that you were talking about, Diane, has to do with this absolute belief that there's always more. The metaphor that we use is somewhat different. We think about the stories that people think represent their lives and how many uncountable more things have happened that we can ask questions to develop those stories that might offer different meanings. And we don't know where they're going to go. It's up to the person what resonates with them. They're at the center of the conversation. But I think that attitude of curiosity and believing that there's always more is really important in the change process. That might be something that's different than a conversation with a friend, for example.
And I do just want to jump back in, and Jean, and say I totally agree with you that you never step out of your biases, your stories, your context. And it's a discipline. I think it's a very discipline that I try to explicitly teach my students. Like, you're never going to get totally out of it, but you want to constantly reflect on what are the every word we use has a bias in it. There's no way to not have bias, but what are those? How are they affecting the client? How are they shaping the conversation? And are we doing it in ethical, responsible ways? I think is just, there's no way to escape that.
Yeah, I love what you're saying. Diane has made a big part of her career and has one of my favorites, if most used text in systemic therapy. So she breaks down very complex models and theories into very usable ways for new learners. In fact, many of our younger, professionally young listeners of the show have read Diane's book and books. But models and theories, how important are they to change? Many people will say that they're essential. Other people say no. It is more of just a dialogue of being an authentic person, building a therapeutic alliance, as we'll talk about later today. So how important are models and theories in your personal work?
For me, the worldview is really important. But I think I could, and I think the worldview is a basis for a model, but there's theoretical aspects. But for me, the important part is to stay situated in the worldview. And I could do things that would be different than what somebody would teach as narrative therapy. But if I'm in the worldview, I feel like that's what's most characteristic and most useful for me in guiding me.
Could you concisely characterize what the narrative worldview is, Jill, for people that might not know?
You could too. Do you want to start and I'll add?
I'm trying in this conversation not to be the all-knowing male here.
I know.
I think I said that previous long speech I gave was a lot of it. It's about relationship and honoring relationship and honoring context. I could cite you a bunch of post-structuralist thinkers and refer you to thinking about Deleuze and Foucault and all that, but that just comes down to the fact that we can't, and the way we're constituted, these things we consider to be ourselves, we can't know the ultimate absolute truth about the universe. So we're always on the way to, with the other people and the other entities we're in context with, making ourselves up as we go along.
Yeah, I think
that's an ethical task. What's the next step we take in creating our little corner of the universe? We're not trying to change individuals. We're trying to participate in relationship in a way that brings forth our best conception of something a little better than where we are at the moment.
So let me just tell a story about that has to do with making ourselves up as we go along. And this was a really early experience. We came from an Ericksonian background, and
Milton Erickson, not Eric.
Yeah, Milton Erickson. And we had written 3/4 of a book using Ericksonian ideas when we first met Michael White. And we were just really intrigued with his work, and we were among the first people in this country, which probably had something to do with an invitation to come to Australia and sit behind the mirror and meet a number of people doing things that were not yet called narrative therapy. And one of the, and we also, Michael said, oh, my friend David Epstein, my friend and colleague David Epstein is also really interested in Milton Erickson. Maybe he would write a blurb for your book. So we sent our book to David. We had never met him. And he invited us when we were in Australia to go to New Zealand and have dinner and spend the night. And so we did that. And he said to us, I really liked your book a lot, except for one thing. And that's the word resources. And we thought that resources was a really good word, and we didn't understand, and we puzzled about it, and we left there completely confused. And we went back to Australia, and Michael said, how did you like David? And we said, oh, he was great. We had a great time, but he didn't like the word resources that we used, which we used a lot. Like we were in the model of that we were in, we were like looking for resources that we could utilize, that people could utilize to solve their own problems. And Michael, so we asked him, like, why is this a problem? And he said, you're acting like people have all these things inside them and you just have to like recognize them. And he said, I think people have the possibility, everyone has the possibility of being very good and also very bad. And when he said that, I became nauseated. Like, really, I had to sit down. And he was saying, you can't really claim something about yourself unless
you're... I just want to clarify. Michael didn't make you sick. You got motion sick because it was like he pulled the rug out from underneath your feet.
I had this idea I was really a good person deep down, no matter what I did. And he said... No, people are good because they're doing good. So you're making yourself up through what you do in relation to the world and other people, wherever it has effects. You can't really claim things about your identity unless what you're doing fits with that.
That's not something that's sitting there already in you. It's something that exists or doesn't exist as you perform it.
I was extremely distressed about that, but I came to think that as a therapist, it's a great thing to believe because we can be part of how people do things that fit with who they're becoming, who they want to become, that we all have the power through the choices we make, the things that we say, the things that we do to be creating, constructing our identity. And so that's really an important part of the worldview for me.
You know, I appreciate that. Diane, your thoughts on theory and technique?
Woo! Wow. I could do several hours on this as a theory textbook author for 30 years. But so I will say, because my thoughts have really evolved over the years. And so I have, I guess, several layers here. And there is this weird thing at this point in my career. I run a licensure prep course for NFTs where I teach people 20 different theories. But my own research has evolved to this unifying framework, which kind of synthesizes all the knowledge in the field. Because one of the reasons I think a framework is so important for the person when you're sitting in the room is that I think 99% of your brain width, bandwidth, has to be in trying to follow the meaning of the client. So you need to be so present. My mind, I've been doing this for over 30 years. My mind never wanders because I'm trying to understand my client's worldview the way they are understanding it. So I think it's really a problem to give people super complex things to think about when you're trying to relate to another human in an ethical way without putting your biases on them. So I think when you're in the room, Eli, I would say it's all relationship. It's all trying to understand. You get 1 or 2% of your brain, maybe 5% if you're having to do a suicide assessment, is going to the research and the theory. But otherwise, you're totally present in that moment. And I also do a lot of work with mindfulness. And so I think that presence, that being with someone, it's almost a sacred moment of connecting. It's so deep. That said,
I think to be able to step into that state of mind, to be able to relate in that way, you need to read a lot of theory, but you're not thinking about it in session because you're fully present. So I think there is this dialectic tension where I think it's very helpful to have theories, and that helps us reflect on our thinking. It helps us hopefully identify some of our biases better and to have more useful ways of thinking about what our clients are talking about. But that, when you're in the room with a person, you're not thinking theory, you're fully present with the other human. So it's a both, and I hope that makes some sense.
Can I ask you a question about it? I'm just trying to think about whether understanding it the way that you are.
Please.
Yesterday, somebody I was supervising asked me if I would interview a colleague of theirs, and then they stopped me and they asked me, like, what kind of question I was asking. I couldn't answer their questions when they were stopping me. And I think because I was doing what you're describing, I was there. And I also think that you also talked about doing all this reading and being involved. I think that might be what I was talking about, worldview. Like, it's already part of me. I'm not thinking about it in the room, but it influences what moment I'm attracted to and might ask a little bit more about.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Exactly. Because the worldview gets created when you're reading, training, having conversations like this, listening to podcasts like this. We're shifting kind of your worldview. The holodeck is the meaning-making system, I like to call it. But when you're with a client, I think it is this very in-the-moment presence. Like you're saying, when people ask, where did that question come from? You're like, you're not reflecting on it because you're in the moment.
And in all of these things in our dialogue is that you are engaging with the client, dialoguing with them in a way to gain access to their worldview, to their meaning-making system. Mm-hmm. And build an alliance. And we know as a common factors guy that like Diane kind of looks at these unifying principles that make a good therapist, that make a motivated client, that tap into things like hope. So a therapeutic alliance is a necessary but not sufficient form of therapy. You have to have more than just that, but it's certainly important. So I'm curious your all's thoughts on what makes a strong alliance. And then ultimately, whether it's an individual, certainly if you have multiple people in a room, there is going to be a tear, or even when we try to do well, the iatrogenic effects of therapy, we try to do well and momentary harm is done. So really master systemic therapists are able to detect tears and then repair tears, whether it be an individual or a couple or a family therapy. So I'm curious on your all's thoughts on maintaining and repairing a therapeutic alliance.
I guess I'll jump in. Yeah, the alliance is, there's nothing without that relationship. There's just nothing. And so that's always what comes first. I think a lot of, especially new therapists, are really excited by some of the conceptualizations and the theories and done. And it's, oh, I have empathy. I've got the relationship. I'm like, oh my God, empathy is, that's first semester. Yeah. The quality of alliance, I think most people underestimate how challenging that is and how much of the work it is, because the other stuff, they want shiny objects. Tell me what to do. What's the intervention? And so I think that the quality of the relationship is important. And I think bringing your full self, authentic self, and I know that can be a little bit challenging when you think of boundaries and what all that means, but I think it's funny. I'm talking with Jill. You were talking about meeting the person apart from the problem. It's also you got to be a human apart from your role, right? And your humanity has to lead, and they need to feel that and trust that. So I like humor. I like to be funny. So I use humor in session. I know some people freak out when they first see me. They're like, you're making jokes. I'm like, yep, I am. And so I think it's real important to bring your authentic full self. And I think that really helps then when repair needs to happen. Because they know who I am. I am not this mysterious person. I don't give tons of details about my life or anything like that, but there is this authenticity that is at the root of it that allows it to be repaired. And I do sincerely care about my clients, and I think they feel that, and I have very clear boundaries too with my clients. And so I think all of that's possible, but there's an authenticity that is really
critical to make repair and the and a safety.
Yeah, I think the relationship is really important. I think it's different every time. I think being willing to and open to taking responsibility to getting something wrong is really important. One of the things that I started doing pretty most of the time that Michael White did was after getting to know people a little bit, he says, what do you want or do you have any questions for me? And people are really taken aback by that. And they say something often like, I don't know what to ask. And I say, you're deciding whether to open your life to me. So it might be important to know something about me. And I'm willing to answer almost everything. I don't want to spend a lot of time with that. I don't want to be the center of the conversation. But I'm trying to say this is a two-way relationship. Even though what we're here about is what you came for, and that's going to be the focus, I'm willing to. And then I also say, so as we're going along, if you want to know why asking about something in particular or interested in something you didn't think was important, ask me, we can talk about it. So it's that's part of something. I'm also thinking about somebody I saw who had been sexually abused for many years by her father as a child. And after I'd seen her for a while, she told me that she interviewed 5 therapists before deciding to see me. And the reason that she decided to see me was that I teared up when she was talking. Yeah, so I think that being yourself, as you were saying, Diane, being is important.
Yeah, and that's fascinating because I often will gasp I go like this when they tell me something. We hear horrific things. We hear about a lot of darkness, and that authenticity, because feel it with them. They can see the visceral reaction sometimes, and the tearing up. I tear up too. That sits with people, and it's very. I think that part of our humanity is important to bring into the room.
I want to go back to the rupture and repair part of your question, Eli. I think part of me being my whole self and present with people in the way that both Diane and Jill have already talked about, I'm a screw up. I'm clumsy. Outside of the therapy room, I'm socially awkward. And so I'm constantly stepping on my own toes, biting my own tongue. I don't mean to over exaggerated. I'm making a point here, but I think in any conversation between two human beings, there's always negotiation going on. There's always micro, maybe we might call them milli microaggressions that we're doing with each other. Because we're feeling each other out. And I think accepting that is part of establishing what anybody would call a workable therapeutic relationship. And being willing to put that on the table, being willing to notice when something's gotten tense, or to say, oh, gosh, I wish I'd said that differently. Or what did it mean just there? It looked like you weren't really pleased with the way I just said that. What's going on? I think just all of those little adjustments make it more likely that you're not going to have to do the big adjustments later on. It's just that, and being real, I do want to say something about something that Jill and I have published a paper on that nobody ever reads, but just about boundaries.
Go ahead.
We think for family therapists and for relationships, for therapists in general, it's more useful to think about the quality of relationship rather than to think about maintaining boundaries. Because boundary is one kind of relationship, really. It's a relationship of quite a bit of distance. But if the emphasis goes on maintaining boundaries, it makes us keep a distance. It makes us think that our role is to be distanced. So we like to think about what's the appropriate relationship in this moment with
people. And what are the effects of what we're doing?
What are the effects of how we're relating?
Yeah. Particularly the ethical effects. 100% yes. Much better language than boundaries, agreed. But I do a lot of training for the licensing exam, so I default.
Therapy is to want to question all that stuff. And we want to be very open about our questioning of all that stuff and to be wanting to try to bring forth a different way of doing it. That's all.
And just to kind of connect with what you're saying, Gene, and I call it the therapist song and dance when we do our verbal informed consent at the beginning. I don't know what else to call it. And Jill, I love the question of, do you have any questions for me? One of the things I talk about with clients when I'm introducing, and you're structuring the relationship, you're kind of laying the ground rules for that. One of the things I always tell my clients is, if ever you're sitting there and I'm maybe giving an idea or saying something and you're nodding your head very politely, silently telling yourself there's no way in the world I'm going to do that. I'm sure it's a great idea for someone else. I'm like, I always say, please let me know. There's like an infinite number of ways for me to be helpful to you. And so a lot of just even starting there, yes, tell me where I'm not getting it. Tell me where you don't like my idea or whatever. And I will be helpful in another way. And you can see like people's relief on their face often, whereas I'm inviting dissent into this conversation. And so, yeah, similar along those lines to make that just from the get-go part of the process.
Yeah, building on what you're all saying, again, when you're your authentic self and you're engaged in a human dialogue with another human in a non-hierarchical way, you're going to misread, you're going to make mistakes. So normalizing that from the get-go, as kind of Gene was saying, it seems certainly essential into forming this alliance. I always think of therapy as a failure-driven progression. We try some things, it doesn't land, we read the feedback, we attune to the worldview, as we've been saying today, and then we try something else. So many times we learn more from our therapeutic fails and even the masters, the collective wisdom and experience we have in the room today, everybody's made mistakes that has ultimately made us a better therapist. So I'm wondering if you can share a significant therapeutic failure that ultimately made you a better therapist and changed your way of thinking about systemic therapy.
A long time ago, probably quarter of a century ago or more, we used to do a lot of co-therapy with families and with couples. And so Jill and I were seeing a couple that we had all, or Jill thinks it was a family session. We saw sometimes it was just the mom and dad about their relationship, and sometimes it was people in the family. But I did something in the therapy that had this was a heterosexual couple, and it had the woman in the relationship feeling like I was siding with the man. And in rather egregious ways, and that I was not being helpful. I was being very unhelpful about that.
Particularly not holding him accountable.
Not holding him accountable for some stuff he'd done. And I thought she was right when she called me on it. So I have to think about what can I do. I asked that woman if she would be a consultant to me. And this is a place where the licensing exam and boundaries and things might cause some people some worry. I don't know. But she was agreeable to, and I paid her the same thing I had been charging them for the session, to do several sessions with me to help me understand how not to make that mistake ever again and to unpack what was going on there. And I learned a lot from that. And I'm still captured by patriarchy at times, even at this point in my life, because it's such a powerful thing. But I'm much less captured by it than I was, because she was willing to do something a little outside the box. And I thought that reciprocity of not just saying, let's talk about it, but really hiring her as a consultant was an important part of that. So that's an example.
Okay, you got me. I'm struggling, but it's funny. Like, trying to think here, and I'm listening so carefully to Gene's story. I'm not in my own, going back through my files.
But it's funny, when I think of probably where I have the most missteps would also be couples, working with couples and missing some of those power dynamics. And I think that is also where knowing how to respond to two people who have very different realities going on in the room and being able to step out and reflect on each of their realities. Are there patriarchal or racist or gender things going on here? There's a lot that's going on. It can be very hard to find words. Now, your question, what have I learned, Eli, right? Is that the question?
Yeah, from a therapeutic mistake, how have you recalibrated and changed the way you work? So in Gene's example, when that client, female client, as a consultant, he understood himself better and he didn't make those same mistakes as far as his gender imbalance. And with couples, many people use that as an example, because unless you're working with the same sex couple, there's almost always a gender imbalance in the room. And we think of another difference that makes MFT different than individual therapy is we see things in relational cycles. And I think the skillful couple or family therapist can frame a cycle to every member in that system, so no one feels like the identified patient, that you're non-pathologizing, and that everybody feels like they have a way of fitting into that cycle. And sometimes when we prioritize one person's part of the cycle or story, it's easy to get what we call a split alliance in couple or family therapy. So lots of people, actually, when I've been asking on these all-star panels, they do use examples like Gene used. So it tells me even the pros make that mistake. But yeah, Diane, anything from your long career would be helpful.
Yeah, to make this practical for maybe listeners too, with couples, I have learned to interrupt sooner.
Yeah.
Like managing that conversation, because I like to, with individuals, you got this nice, organic, and safe conversation. But with couples, I've learned I have to be a little bossier and to make sure that I step in sooner to make sure the conversation stays productive and it doesn't escalate or something gets said that I spend then the rest of the session repairing that, rather than, I think, moving in a more productive way. So I think couples certainly noticing the subtle power dynamics in couples and then knowing how to step in soon enough and how to language in ways that keeps both people feeling understood, supported, connected, and meaningfully helps move them in a productive direction. And for me, a lot of that took some learning to be, I feel bossy. I don't think I'm being bossy, but it's more directive or involved or curating the conversation than I sometimes would prefer. But jumping in there, shaping and directing, I think is, the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a great one because, yes, we need to see the cycle and join the system in order to change the system. The problem is if we see the cycle over and we can't intervene, we lose hope as the therapist and the couple becomes demoralized. So yeah, your window of breaking that cycle up, I think any good relational therapist has to have that directive part of their self of therapist to be able to do that. I always say you could do that at home for free. We're here to do something different. And it is a very different way because you're right. When you're in the room with an individual, you can spend time, you can prioritize their worldview, really get to know, but your window of tolerance for doing that with a couple or a family and still being credible is probably less. That's a great example. You have thoughts on a failure that you've learned a lot from, Jill?
What I'm thinking about, in some ways, is a counterpoint to what's been talked about. So this is a heterosexual couple who I'd seen for a while, and they came in one day and they were going to be going on vacation. And the man was like saying, I work really hard. I make a lot of money. We could go on amazing trips. But she's always just taking us to a beach somewhere. Like it doesn't take any planning or any creativity. She just makes us these airline tickets and we just sit on a beach. And I said, how is it that she's completely in charge of deciding where you go on vacation and making the tickets? And he says, I'm not going to answer that question. And she starts to answer. And he says, don't answer. That's a political question. And then he said, I wish we had interviewed you about your politics before we came to see you, because I to become. And so I don't know exactly what I did, but one of the things that I said was, would you like me to refer you to someone else? Because he was just telling me how I didn't understand. And he said, no, we've started with you. You know us. We don't want to change. But I would say something and he'd say, that's a political question. Don't answer. And this went on for a couple of sessions until we finally decided that it wasn't a good idea. For me, what I learned was to slow down, because I think I could have asked a series of questions that would have made it possible to talk about how they organized their relationship that wouldn't have felt so confronting and blaming. And I think it was my wanting to do something quickly that really was felt assaultive to him. I think it was, I certainly would see it a certain way, but I think I would think much more about like how it's going to feel to the person and be really clear, like he didn't invent that way of dividing up responsibilities. This isn't about him, but it is about the way, about gender relations and power relations, and those are demonstrated all over. And so I just wish, I think what I try to do is be much more slower and scaffold getting to talking about how they've divided things up.
Oh, I love that. We've heard that a lot too when I've talked to master's therapists, because many times they have a limited amount of time, or sometimes they are in a consultation model where they may only have maybe an hour or two. So to try to be as maximally helpful in trying to get all of your stuff in, but when you don't have that relationship, they don't understand the context. Yeah, it could be seen, because the way you said that question to me, I wasn't in the room. It didn't sound political for me, but then I don't know that guy. You are just getting to know them. So I think the idea of slowing down and our need to, as I said, get everything in rush, I think that is a great feedback to take in and a great counterpoint. Another thing I have been interested in, you look at master clinicians, and not as much is written about this or research. It's like everybody has their own way of preparing for their caseload that day. We have answers that range to, I've been doing it so long, it's just kind of like muscle memory. I come in, I go to pour a cup of coffee and get ready to see my people. Where other master therapists have, even if it becomes automatic, a very particular way of preparing for their day or for a particular session. So this is one of my favorite questions to ask, is everybody's answered it a little differently and no one really talks about this. They've been doing what you're doing at a very high level for a long time and being very clinically active. How do you prepare for a session or a series of sessions on a particular day? Your rituals of preparation, so to speak.
I take notes when I'm seeing people. And so beforehand, I look at the notes. If I feel like it's not going really well, I go back and I look beyond. But if it's going well, I usually look at the notes from that time. And when I start, I ask people if they'd like me to read the notes from the time before to them. And the reason I do that is a lot of people have this idea when they're coming to therapy that they're going to report everything that went wrong. And I'm interested in that we're developing this narrative that's hopefully going in more preferred directions. And if I'm doing a retelling and then asking how that's continuing, I feel like it's going to be more productive. Of course, if they say, we want to talk about something else, that's fine. But I find that a lot of people, if I just sit down and say, how are you? They say, aren't you going to read the notes? So people appreciate that kind of orientation, and it's orienting for me too.
And it's also, you're modeling a kind of ritual for them. It lets them know that you are intentional, that you review, and you're making it, again, transparent. It's nothing hidden. And you give them choice in it too, which I think is wonderful. That's great.
Thanks.
Oh my God. I am a bit different in how I prepare. So
think about these panels. I tell you, this one differently. Yeah.
It's fascinating. So I practice mindfulness and meditation. So I always do some meditation to just get myself really centered. If there's stressful things going on, just getting really trying to step out of that narrative, the narrative of all the little things going on in my life, to just be fully present. I think ritual is real important. Post-pandemic, I'm the only one in my office usually, Fridays. So I go in and I turn on all the lights in a certain way and open the blinds and set up the room. And when I'm doing that, it's a ritual where I am preparing, I'm bringing myself to center. And so I try to get to a really calm, centered place. I do look at who's coming in. And I normally do that, I don't know, 3 minutes before people walk in. I don't take notes, and I do, but I get as clear as I can to be fully present and to make myself present. But I do always, one of my working assumptions is that I have no idea what has happened since the last time I saw this person. And so I don't want to make any assumptions about where they're at. But I always keep in mind the thread, the theme of where we left off. And then I'm like, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that could happen. I have no idea what it is, especially with couples and families. Oh my, it seemed like so many other conversations could have happened. I assume nothing. But then I try to pick up and weave in where they say they're at, because that's where their energy is. And I try to follow their energy and then bring in whatever we talked about last time once I find where their energy is, because I try to follow where their motivation is in the moment. So I would say that's how I prepare.
Thank you, Vivian. Jean.
Jill and I influence each other a lot, but I'm more random and haphazard and sloppy than Jill. But I carry an awareness of the people I'm working with. And so the first thing I do is when I wake up in the morning, I look at my schedule for the day. And I look at who's scheduled. And if I have a pretty clear memory of the last session with people, and it comes to me, oh, that's what we're working on, then I might not go back and formally review the notes. That would be depending on some things about that. If I don't have a clear memory, that's the first place I go, is to my notes. So let's get back in touch. You've lost the thread here, Jean. I also think about the kinds of communications we do post-therapy and narrative therapy as a part of the preparation for the next session. I'm very far from writing a therapeutic letter after every session. Something monumental and worth memorizing has to happen for me to write a big letter about it, or we have to be really stuck. If we're really stuck, I might go back and write a letter that kind of summarizes my understanding of the therapy to date and is following up with some questions about this. This is where I think we are. And my questions about where you want to go with this are blah, 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 blah. So I might do those big formal things that you read about if you read about narrative therapy at those key times. But it's not unusual for me to, with permission, with understanding ahead of time, to shoot off an email to somebody about, it just came into my mind, and I'm wondering how that little project we identified in your last session is going. So for me, it's not so much about preparing for the day or for the session as it is feeling a thread of relationship of my involvement with those people in their life, and how can I be useful? Oh, the other thing is that Diane's talking about mindfulness, and that overlaps so much with presence and resonance and all of this stuff that goes into therapeutic relationships. I find that when I'm doing therapy is the one time in my life that I can count on being my definition of mindful. And I think that comes from long practice. Just my version of sitting is sitting with people rather than sitting by myself. And I can pretty much count on the fact that once I've clicked the join session on Zoom, or preferably once I've shut my office door, I'm there. And I value that. I really value that.
I just love that, because in the last book Harleen and I edited, my contribution is how collaborative dialogic practice is a mindfulness practice. It's the same thing. You're staying in the present moment and tracking that. And so I 100% agree with you. It's a form of meditation. this type of work. I would say it's a form of meditation.
And I just want to honor Harleen here in this conversation. She, going back to my formative time as trying to learn to be a family therapist, Harry and Harleen, but Harleen especially, just her, the way she is there.
Her presence.
And her memory. The way she can hold what's happening in a session and without taking notes, come back 3/4 of the way through a session to something that was there earlier. She's just been holding that in her awareness. She's always been a model for me for that. Then I have other models, Milton Erickson, Michael White, but Harleen's one of my real models for how I want to be relating with people.
I would agree to that. And I think it really made a difference those early days when we weren't just having conferences that were about one model, but they were more interactive and sets of ideas, different theoretical models that came together that had overlap where we could watch other people and get something from other people. And I really miss that. And Harleen and Harry were big parts of that in our learning.
When even earlier we were talking about the humanity, and one of the things she's been saying lately is that ultimately therapy is one human being having a human experience with another human being. And her emphasis on our way of being in the conversation that we've all talked about in multiple ways and angles today, and just the quality of your presence. She talks about the philosophical stance. And I think her work is just highlighted that for so many of us and transformed us. And I didn't get the chance to meet Harry, so I only know Harleen. A little younger to all this work. But yeah, the way that she highlights that and demonstrates it and lives it and is a role model for it, I think is really powerful. Just who you are, your way of being human when you're doing this work is the heart and soul.
That really is the heart and soul of any good therapy. Somebody, a client is looking for a therapist that is a real person. Therapy is not something, as we've said today, that is done to somebody else. It is something you engage with someone else in a real human interaction and in making meaning. And we've all been centering on this same place. And what I've been asking people as the last question, and because I have people on the panel that know each other, and part of this all-star panel was, let's get people that you not necessarily think everything alike, but you respect, and sometimes you respect them because they do therapy differently. You are all just talking about what you admire about Harleen and what she does to stay present and authentic. So none of that is in a textbook or can be coached. That is inherent to the self of therapists. I'm wondering, and I'll start with our professional and personal duo in real life, a husband and wife team that we talked about on the first podcast, Jill and Jean, if you could, and if Diane too, and you can tell each other what you admire about them that is a self of therapist quality that cannot be taught, you're born with it, that makes you effective. I'm curious what you think, especially for Jean and Jill, who've been working together for so long. Jean, what do you respect about Jill that makes her effective in a way that you admire because you don't have that necessarily same quality, but it works for Jill?
Jill is very practical. And Jill is very methodical in a non-machine-like way. She does. She takes careful notes. She reviews those notes. She always knows where she is in a therapy session. Or she, and that might be lost, but where she is might be lost. But she knows she's there. And she's working to get back to a useful place in the conversation. And she, when she's on her game and things are, it's not a super difficult time and things haven't blown up, you can see her develop a little bit of story, ask people to reflect on the new place we're in now that we've been reflecting on this story. And now that we're in this place, what can you see as the next step? Where do you want to go from here? Am I right about that? Now, what's the next step you want to take from here? Okay. Let's explore some things you already know about that. And what are some of the stories you could tell me about people you know that have taken that kind of step? And well, there'll be some more story. And then they'll be, okay, we're here now. And what meaning do you derive from that? What does that say about who you are and the possibilities for you? And it's, I don't have that kind of way to track. I can describe it in Jill, but, and she's got a wonderful sense of humor. Having her office beside mine, working in the same office with her for 40 years now, going on, what you hear mostly coming through her door is laughter, even with really heavy stuff. And she is responsible, just dependable and responsible. And if she were my therapist, I'd feel great because I would know she had my back in whatever best way she could.
And I love it.
And I don't know Diane's work as well. I know Diane's work from seeing each other at conferences and reading her work, but I appreciate just even here in this conversation, the thoughtfulness and the care and the self-reflection that has to go into producing the body of work that she's produced. And that, I think that kind of, I could never teach one of those survey courses. The wall. And I'm philosophically opposed to them at a lot of levels. I think it would be better for people to learn one or at most three models more deeply than it would be to waste time learning the most superficial description you could ever come up with of 20 models. And then having to be tested, that's just structuralist crap. That
I have an article criticizing why we think people learn 20 theories for the life.
But I believe that people like Diane, and Diane in particular, because of the way people like her books, that she's able to do that in a way that informs who she wants to be and how she wants to be. And not to get overly caught up, like I get caught up in my rebellion about that stuff in ways that sometimes are useful and sometimes are just a waste of time. So I'll shut up.
No, that was great. I would take turns and you can hear the good things they have to say about you. Jill, why don't you go next?
Okay. So Gene thinks at a really abstract level, which I appreciate. He is much more aware of theory and philosophy and history than I am, which can be really helpful and particularly useful in talking with some people who think in that way, whereas my practical focus sometimes doesn't resonate for someone. So I appreciate that a lot. I appreciate how he has a kind of patience and slow willingness and ability to slow down in ways that's really useful. I get very concise, and particularly with teaching, it's really helpful to be able to unpack concepts and slow them down, and he's really good at that. I admire his willingness to take stances on things, even if they're not popular, because he believes in them. He really stands for what he really is clear about what he stands for. Sometimes I try to get him not to do that, but I admire it, even though I try to get him not to do that, because I have to create waves. I'm pulling and say, sit down, don't. But I also admire it at the same time. Yeah. So those are some of the things that stand out for me.
And Diane, I know we were all colleagues here, but I'm curious what you think about Gene and Jill, and certainly what makes you effective as well. I have some thoughts on that, but I know we are pressing against a time limit here, so I want to give you a chance to get in there, Diane.
I still have to say, I'm still starstruck being with on a call with Gene and Jill. And I will say that the two of you made such a huge impression on me early in my career. And I still have this memory. I think we were in Chicago. Your daughter wasn't in kindergarten yet. So what, 25 years ago, something like that.
She's 29.
She just had her 29th birthday.
Yeah, I was thinking about 25 years ago. And you all had a conversation with me. And this was early in my career. I don't even know if I was done with my doctorate or where I was in my training.
But I just remember you treated me like a human being. I mean, I still almost have tears when I think about this. It was so powerful to be so young in my career and have these two stars. Like, we had a human conversation. I talked with your daughter. And I still have this memory of the two. She's holding both of your hands walking down the street. It's Chicago, MFT conference, somewhere like that. And just how profound an effect that had to be seen by the two of you. Oh, for me, the humanity in both of you has stuck with me for all of these years. When I write about your work, I always smile. And it's the scene I have with your little girl. She probably doesn't want to hear this. She's 3 or 4 years old. You're both holding her hand. And it is this photograph that is so crystal clear in my memory. And it was just, I was seen as a human. I am seeing the two of you as humans, parents with this little girl, and just totally human moment. And I think it's sad to say how often I don't feel that professionally in groups that I'm with. So I think of you as two real, just good souls and human beings. So I think that sticks out for me. And certainly to agree, I agree, Jill. I think of Jean as having a lot of courage. And I'm sorry, there was an article on privilege you wrote. How long ago was that? 5, 10 years ago, something like that, right? Am I getting the right word?
It was pre-COVID. It was on white privilege.
White privilege. And I remember when I saw that, I was like, wow, that took courage. Kind of like Jill. I hope this all plays out well for him.
I just have to say, as long as we're mentioning people's names, if Fred Piercy asked me to do that, and when I tried to say, no, somebody else could do this better, and he kept at me. So it's all Fred Piercy's fault.
Okay. Love it. Another good soul. That took courage, but you did do it. And that certainly stands out. And just the humanity of both of you and your work and what you've brought to the field, it's very precious. It's very precious.
But what is precious to me is that whenever I have asked the three of you all to participate in anything, you have always been gracious. And I know that how busy we are. Diane's going to go off to another important media interview right now. So I feel privileged to know you. And again, we need more Diane's and Jean's and Jill's. But to have this kind of dialogue, every time I do this, it reminds me of why I still do what I do. And 24 years into my career, I just feel so blessed to do something, as you were saying earlier, Gene, and be present for people. And I still feel the way I did when I was a beginning family therapy student all those years ago in Chicago. And this podcast is a way of honoring that. And we've mentioned a lot of great people today, but I appreciate you all so much. And I know our listeners, they enjoyed listening to you the first time. And as we say, the whole is greater than the sum of our parts. So our dialogue today has tapped into that. I wish you all well, and thank you for being part of this all-star panel.
Can I just say a few words? I know you're finishing, but I want to just thank you, Eli, for these podcasts that I know are really valuable and that you put so much into and create such a beautiful context.
Yeah.
And also, Diane, I just want to say I was really excited to be able to be in a conversation with you for this and thought back to like when we were in more context where we got to overlap and see each other. And that's always been a really positive experience for me. So I'm glad to have this connection again.
Thank you. Same here. We need to go back to have more of those type of in-person connections. I'm glad to talk as well.
And I want to get three last thoughts in quickly, if I can. Yeah. One is thank you for reawakening that memory. I was feeling Lily's hand, my little hand, as we were walking, and that's just so precious. The other is one of your questions you didn't get to on the list you gave us was about hope. And I think most of the people we've named here, including Milton Erickson, just had a way of embodying something great's going to happen here as they sat with people. There are possibilities. There's more than what's going on here. And I think that is really needed in these particular times, facing some of the things I think what people are struggling with when they come to see me these days is hanging on to some hope that things might turn out okay. Just hope. And I really think this is great work you're doing. I think it's important work. And I know a little bit about how much discipline and time and pre-work and post-work it takes to produce a podcast like this one. So full of gratitude, and want whoever's listening here to know that wouldn't happen without a ton of work from you.
Thank you all so much. What an inspiring conversation that was. Listening to Diane, Gene, and Jill together reminds us of just how vibrant and evolving our field truly is. The spirit of the all-star panels, what a great dialogue. Their shared wisdom and mindfulness, narrative, and the deep meaning-making that happens in therapy captures the best of what our show and what the podcast series, the all-star panels, is supposed to capture. That change is always co-created through language, connection, and compassion. Each of them in their own ways invited us to slow down, stay curious, and honor the stories that shape our clients and ourselves. If you've enjoyed these all-star panel conversations, be sure to check out other episodes in this special series featuring the trailblazers and the innovators who've defined our field and those carrying it forward. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, pass it along to a friend or colleague. Remember, there's now 7 full seasons of in-depth interviews, thought-provoking discussions with the biggest names in our field, all available in our podcast archive. Make sure to follow the AAMFT on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, X for the latest updates in our profession. Please subscribe to the show, leave a review, let us know what you want to hear next. To connect with me directly, visit elikaram.com. That's ELIKARAM.com for free resources, speaking info, and more. If you're looking to grow your clinical skills or pass that pesky MFT exam, check out my 2 latest books, Marriage and Family Therapy, Official National Exam Study Guide. It's a comprehensive evidence-informed guide designed to help you conquer the AMFT-RB license exam with confidence. It's got practice questions, exam strategies, and insights from yours truly. Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy with AAMFT President and my co-author Adrian Blow is written to ignite your energy and creativity. It offers a practical roadmap for using the common factors to enhance your effectiveness, reduce burnout, and revitalize your systemic work, whether you're a seasoned clinician or you're just starting out. Until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay curious, and most importantly, stay systemic.